here, LexCoachMike.com. Premium guys, love you to death. Special thanks to our buddies at Crossover for sponsoring this podcast. Man, I love this product. It's getting better every year. The shot chart and the things you can do with it now and the coding done by them is incredible. I encourage you to take a good listen to it. This is kind of a unique podcast. A guy I've known a long time, Coach Ken Lovick at Georgia Tech. First part of the podcast, we focus on his presidency of the MCLA. And I think he gives some pretty honest and forthright insight about the challenges of what they've tried to accomplish in his 5 years as president, what lies ahead for them. Then we kind of move into Georgia Tech and the practicing as a team. This is a team I've coached against, kind of interesting, how he's modified or kind of evolved in his practice ideas and his philosophies for the team, consistent with the kind of players they have. And they do a great deal of recruiting there for an MCLA team. Kind of who fits right. We talk about the penalty corner. Got an interesting philosophy to Coach Lovick. 4v3 is really 4v4 because he's got a goalie and how he expresses that. Cover the dome drill, the Lovick drill, their camps at gtlaxcamps.com. Anyway, it's a really interesting podcast. Covers a lot of different stuff. And he's got a very unique perspective, actually a lot different perspective, I think, than I do on some of the drills, and including the 5v5 that we feature in the article section. Anyway, without further ado, here is the almost 20-year head coach at Georgia Tech, been coach of the year numerous times, been to the national playoffs, SCLC championships 4 times. Interesting perspective. I hope you enjoy. Special thanks to Crossover. Special thanks to you. Without further ado, Coach Ken Lovick.
Hey, Lax Coach Mike here, LaxCoachMike.com. Coach Ken, this is my radio voice. You like it? I am really thrilled today. Got a long time friend of mine, prominent name in the coaching circles, Coach Ken Lovick from Georgia Tech, and also president of the MCLA, which I've had the pleasure of coaching in. Coach, always great to have MCLA coaches on, man. Welcome to LaxCoachMike.com.
Well, thanks so much, Coach. I've been a long-time fan of it, of what you do, and so hopefully I can add a little bit to it without taking too much away from the great stuff you've built.
Well, the good news is, man, I'm very average at this, you know. So if you do slightly above average, you should, like, kick my tail. I mean, it'll be no problem.
Well, I'll strive to get to average then.
Hey, Coach, what is this like? Is this your fifth year as the president of the MCLA?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the? I know you were always active in their high or upper end administration. Can you tell me kind of how that position came about and what your thoughts were when you accepted that position, and what the job description of that position is really?
Sure. It started many years ago. Probably 10+ years ago, in one of the MCLA meetings out. And back then, it was the USL. MBIA out in
right.
Seattle, and our old friend John Paul was the president. So when Michigan was in our league, and he was the president, and they had an open position on their executive committee, and he knew I was going to be attending, representing the SCLC, and so he sought me out just because of my experience of being around as a coach for a while and just being in the world of recreation and working with sport clubs and all that, and I, you know, happily accepted it and served on the board as the vice president, as a board member for a number of years, and sort of took over the competition area, which was overseeing sort of our policies and procedures, making sure eligibility was okay. And it sort of morphed into when we moved away from our poll establishing who went to the national tournament to me overseeing our selection committee, which was a big move for us, is to sort of take it on ourselves and sort of follow our NCAA brethren in terms of having a selection committee and a group of coaches who were going to try to look at it as honestly as they could to select our members and seed our teams for the national tournament. And then soon after that, Tony Scazzaro, who had then become president, stepped away, and I was more than excited and happy to jump in the role of president. As a job description, though, I wish there was a definitive one for all of us. But the fire is going to put out, or in fact, right before this phone call, I got a little fire from me that we're dealing with. But it's not really a job description, other than just trying to do our best to to make the MCLA, you know, great and if not better than it already is.
Yeah, I think the listeners are probably split. You know, I think with you being on, we'll have a lot of listeners that are very familiar with the MCLA, and maybe some, you know, in areas where the MCLA doesn't have a strong representation that aren't maybe as familiar. But I know, you know, when I got involved in it in my tenure at Auburn, I was very impressed with the tracking of the eligibility, 4 years eligibility for the players, the policies and the protocol on reporting statistics, was it 24 hours or 48 hours so they could be posted. It's an extremely well-run operation and obviously gigantically large and probably the number one choice for a lot of players. At least that's been my experience, you know, west of the Mississippi. We'll see, you know, with the advent of the new programs, you know, what happens. But I know when I've done coaching clinics and like Arizona as an example, man, those guys were all fired up, you know, to play for Arizona State or go out and play for Brigham Young or I don't want to leave anybody out. You know, I don't mean to name drop, but yeah, the league is amazing, you know, and like I said, not just from an administration perspective, but, you know, being involved in lacrosse for 40 years, I was so impressed with the level of competition. Even in the SELC, the Southeast Lacrosse Conference, which at one time was the largest conference in the MCLA. Is it still the largest, Coach?
Still is, yeah. We're still, even though a few have left for NAIA and even varsity, it's still the biggest on the SELC, for sure.
So, Coach, give us an idea of maybe some of the changes or steps forward you've taken in the last couple of years, and then what's on your plate going forward in terms of the growth and prosperity of the MCLA?
Yeah, I think the last few years, the big advent we've done is hire our first, you know, quote-unquote employee. That's Jack Coyne, who's handling a lot of our external relationships and external marketing. I mean, our website, I think, has come a long way. With him on board in terms of the number of stories, the coverage that we, you know, he has all the stats for that in terms of our Twitter, Facebook, just the hits on the website, and a lot of it's due to him. Where in the past we were kind of relying on teams to hopefully get us information or maybe find a couple of people who had an interest in the NCLA who might submit a couple of stories. So that's been a real big push for us, I think, in terms of getting a little more recognition and getting, you know, folks like Inside Lacrosse or Lax Power, whoever it is, just to post our stuff or cover us or, you know, link to the stories that Jack puts out there. That was something we were, you know, real excited about getting him on board for. And Jack's been a real godsend for us in terms of just helping on that end. Cause you know, like you said, I mean, not many folks really know what we're about. They just attach the word club to it. And I think Jack's done a really nice job of trying to help us, you know, kind of overcome that. And it's not to say that there are some, you know, club teams out there. There are in our organization, but there are a number of really, really good organized programs out there that, you know, that are very, very much mimicking a varsity experience. Obviously there's some things that we cannot do that varsity world does, but I think in the scheme of things that there's a lot of kids getting a great opportunity on some great campuses and still playing a competitive sport they love. So Jack's been great in terms of us just trying to get more into people's, you know, eyeballs in terms of seeing what we're all about and learning a little bit more about who we are. So that's been great. Our national tournament's been sort of our highlight. We're unique in how we run that. Again, because, you know, the limitations we have with how our programs are run, you know, we run sort of a festival-type format where, you know, we bring 16 Division I and 16 Division II teams to one area for a week-long tournament. It's a drain, as I've learned the last couple of years, and it's tough, but, you know, there's really no other way for us to do it currently, with the financial, you know, limitations that we have as an organization and the teams do for that matter. But right now the event's working pretty good and it really provides a really neat atmosphere, especially the first couple of days when everybody's out there playing. And, you know, we've been in California for the last 4 years and that's been a great thing. We're moving to the Salt Lake City area for the next couple, 3 years, and excited about being there, especially with the advent of or the move of Utah Lacrosse. They're certainly gaining momentum and attention. So being in their backyard, at least this year while they're still with us, is going to be a nice hopefully a nice attractive piece to the puzzle that we do with our national tournament. So we're excited about that. And, you know, Jack and Matt Holman, who's our tournament director, make the trip to Baltimore or Philly, wherever it happens to be each year when they do the U.S. Lacrosse Convention. You know, to continue to pub us and get people to learn more about us and how big we are, how many places we are located. So those are some things that are going on right now. I mean, we're, you know, a lot
Ken,
of
how many teams are in the MCLA total?
Right now we're just under 200. We're about 180.
I was going to say it's over 150. So, yeah.
Yeah. So wow. We were over 200 for a while. The NAIA teams, split off to start their own national tournament. Which we're certainly happy for them. We hated to see them go because there's some very organized, competitive teams, but it was the natural progression, the natural maturity of what the NAIA is becoming in terms of the growth of the sport in that association. So we've still got a couple NAIA teams with us, but the vast majority left. So, yeah, we're still growing. It seems like every year when we lose a couple, we seem like we gain a couple. So it seems like we're sort of flatlining with that high, you know, high 100s number, close to 200. So we're real happy about where we are.
And what's on the docket for the next 3 years, Coach?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's trying to evaluate, you know, what we need to do. I mean, we talk internally a lot about our policies, procedures, things we need to change to tighten the ship a little bit as much as we can. I think the big thing that we're probably going to really look at the most is probably our national tournament. And like I said, in terms of does that festival format work? Is it best for our competitive aspect? To try to get to maybe some regionals with a Final Four setup. You know, and it's something that our members, the teams that have been to the national tournament numerous times have sort of asked and wanted us to look into. And we try. We've looked at it. It's not like we haven't done it, but, you know, there's still an issue of just, you know, mechanics. I mean, we're not a big organization in terms of workers and volunteers. And so to run regional sites is a little more daunting for us in terms of just how we would tackle that. So I think that's one thing we'll certainly look at over the next few years. We want to look at, you know, like anybody else, we're trying to figure out, you know, more sponsorship opportunities. We continue to try to find partnerships with folks that can hopefully make this sport a little more affordable for our teams. As you know, when you coached MCLA, and, you know, it's a lot of it's on the back of these kids or the back of these parents. And so if we can find, you know, hotel partners, travel partners, equipment partners, anything that can help these kids out a little bit, just to make the sport a little more affordable, something we want to do. And, you know, we've done that a lot with some of the money we have now. We've actually, if teams stay in our, if we have a tournament village of hotels, and if in the last few years, now if the team stays in that village, we provide free transportation for them. We pay for the buses to get them around. And that's, you know, a couple of hiccups early on, but for the most part, I think we've done a really nice job of supplying that. And that saves a team that's out, you know, travels all the way to California, I mean, thousands of dollars for having to rent vehicles or buses or things like that, airport transfers. So we have really tried to at least spend, you know, our money to make sure that it's being returned to the players as much as possible.
Hey, man, I feel bad. You know, being a corporate guy, you would have thought I would have prepped better for this. I'm so sorry. Who are your current sponsors, Ken? Can you give me an idea of who they are and what the levels, or maybe sponsors, the wrong word, partners that you have, or people that have really played an integral part in the growth and the professionalism of the MCLA where it is today?
Well, I certainly wish it was a list of 100 folks, but it is not. It's tough, as you know, trying to find folks that want to donate that dollar. Everyone is happy to give value in kind. In fact, Jack and I are talking to a few different folks over the next couple of weeks about new partnerships for the 2018 season. Our main sponsor, and has been great to us the last 4 years now, is Under Armour. They've been very, very good to us. You know, the former lacrosse marketing guy played in the MCLA, so he had a real heart, you know, had a soft spot in his heart for us. Pardon me. Soft spot. I can't say that fast enough or slow enough. They've been very good to us financially and value in kind. And so that's been really nice having them as the official supplier. Blackroll was with us for a number of years, but they've had to step away. It seems like they're maybe not where they want to be anymore, unfortunately. And so Universal Lacrosse has stepped on as a team supplier. So they're with us right now and doing great things. And I'm trying to work with a couple hotel chains right now to get a partnership for the 2018 season that hopefully our teams can jump into. But what's interesting is that I found that there's a lot more booking agencies out there, travel agencies, that do these team travels with hotel deals and kickbacks for the teams And so that might be a better resource for us, because that way the kids aren't limited to, say, a certain chain or something like that. So that's the stuff we're working on, a website company. I'm meeting with actually tomorrow and another one next week to maybe offer our kids an opportunity to get an easy turnkey, you know, website design for their programs to help their marketing, to help their recruiting. Again, just different ways for us to partner on that way. So that's currently what we have. Again, I wish there was a list of a lot more, but it's just hard to find those dollars that people want to throw around these days.
Well, like I said, man, I can remember my first MCLA game when I came to Atlanta was coming up and watching your guys play. And I can remember specifically, you know, and that was probably the early 2000s. I mean, I know you had that SCLC championship team in 04. But I can remember going to the game and being really, really impressed. And this is going to sound so stupid, man, but I was impressed with the uniforms. I'm watching the pregame. I'm watching the way the thing was run. You've made some improvements to your home facility there at Georgia Tech recently. But at the end of the day, you know, I can remember looking at the uniforms going like, oh, my gosh, you know, these are, you know, $200 or $300 uniforms, you know. And the guys were outfitted and the helmets all matched. And, I mean, I don't mean that negatively, but I'm saying I think that from, you know, my lacrosse background, I had a stigma in my mind about what I considered club to be, you know. And then that was even more reinforced, obviously, when I went to Auburn. And, you know, as you and I talked, incidentally, for the listeners, man, I had some weird experiences at Auburn. And I would call Ken at the worst times and cry on his literally cry on his shoulder. You remember, Coach? I would cry on the phone to you, you know, I mean, with questions, and you mentored me. But, yeah, I think there's a dichotomy, if you will, in the support that the programs get from the universities, you know. And I know in my tenure I kind of learned, you know, through, you know, Matt at Tennessee and some of the other Coach Buff and at Clemson, you know, the university support and what the budgets were really kind of a paradigm, you know. And as I would tell them, the support that we were getting from Auburn, which I think was in the neighborhood of $20,000 a year, you know, a lot of universities, the club budgets didn't go that far out, you know, to support some of those programs. But at the end of the day, you know, regardless of how they get there, man, when they come out to play, you know, it's good lacrosse, man, and the guys are outfitted and the players are skilled and the coaches, I think the coaches in the MCLA are getting consistently better and better and better. You know, for many years in many programs, it was a grad assistant or the guy that was there one more year. You know, now you're getting coaches that, well, I mean, even some of the guys I mentioned, you know, you start mentioning names like that mentored me, like Harkin and Buff Grubb and you. And, I mean, these are 20-year experienced coaches with championship rings, you know.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting, and I've been very lucky, especially being in Atlanta, where, you know, and I know you interview a lot of coaches, but there's a lot of guys out there that choose, you know, a profession outside lacrosse, but their passion still lies in lacrosse. And so the NCAA, you know, can afford that luxury, which is nice. I mean, I've had some guys that have been here for, you know, for their jobs that have led them here. And to be able to just coach sort of on a part-time, and a part-time, I don't use that in the right term, but it's not their full-time job. The NCAA offers a great thing, especially when you've got California and a lot of places where, or maybe kids in graduate school getting his PhD or master's or whatever it may be at a school that's not as located in an urban area like we are. But the NCAA can offer a great way to still stay involved in the game, coach in a competitive atmosphere, but not feel like you have to do it, you know, 80 hours a week like some guys are having to do, you know, on the Division I, Division II, and Division III level and still maintain a family and a job. And so I think there's a lot of luxuries, and I think a lot of things that are attractive about coaching in NCAA, just depending on where you are or what opportunities that lie in the area of where you are.
Well, and with that comes challenges, man. I mean, I know one of the things I cried to you about on a regular basis was, you know, the club mentality and getting everybody in a culture on the same way. And I'll never forget Buff Grubb telling me, Mike, Buff Grubb is a great coach. He was at Tennessee, now he's at Clemson. But at the end of the day, he was saying it takes 3 years to build a culture, you know. And I think one of the things as we kind of transition into Georgia Tech lacrosse, I think one of the things that I was always so envious of you and the program at Georgia Tech was the culture and the commitment of the players, you know, which I don't want to rain on Auburn, but I don't think I ever reached that at Auburn. And as a coach, I don't think I ever mastered, you know, having a percentage of the team that was not live or die serious, although some programs are live or die serious, and you and I know who they are. Certainly, you know, the Colorado States, you know, 5 years ago and stuff like that. But it's more than coaching lacrosse. You know, I think it's a much huger challenge to coach in the MCLA in terms of establishing the culture, you know. And then once you establish the culture or get everybody committed to a common goal, to whatever degree, you know, you can, then you, I mean, I would have guys at Auburn that would never show up for practice and show up for games and be mad they didn't play, you know, and turns out they never paid their dues and blah, blah, blah. But I think there's an additional challenge to not being an NCAA coach in terms of the culture and getting the team all on the same page in terms of whatever level of commitment they decide to do.
Yeah. You know, you and I've talked a lot about this. And I'm, you know, very lucky in the situation I'm in, but, you know, I've seen it. I've dealt with it. I've had to talk to a lot of coaches about it over the years. And it is tough, especially when someone maybe come in who can't dedicate the time or isn't going to be there, you know, sort of maybe long-term, like maybe it's not a place they're settling down or whatever. So it can be really, really tough, especially when there's maybe a lot more distractions than maybe another campus has or something like that, or the culture.
Oh, you're so politically correct. Distractions. Nice. Very nice, Coach. Very, very nice.
Yeah, we don't have that same kind of distraction typically at Tech, but, you know, but yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's tough, especially if there's a culture that has been there for longer than, you know, than say 3 years. If there's a certain culture that's been put in place for, you know, 6 or 10 or 12 years, and then all of a sudden, you know, you look up and a coach wants to try and change that in three, that you got to, just changing it in three is one thing, but you better be around for the next three, because, you know, if you left after three, then all the work you've done is gone. And so it is a tough balance to try to figure out the right way and or the best way to get, you know, the commitment or what level you want it. Some guys are happy to coach in a little more loose and, you know, liberal way of just saying we're going to kind of take it, you know, one day at a time and maybe we'll be successful that way. And you know, but that, you know, that's not for everybody, but it certainly can work though.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard, you know, because I think, the longer you coach, at least for me, and this would be a nice transition question, man, I think, you know, the longer I coach, the more I realize that, and, you know, Bill Tierney said something to me really interesting one time. He said, I've come to not treasure Saturdays because it's the day I coach the least. And, you know, as I become more mature and have had winning teams and teams that didn't win and, you know, done really well and gotten slaughtered and all that stuff. And I've been blessed, you know, I've coached in Calgary, I've coached in Ontario, I've coached in Baltimore. But at the end of the day, I think I'm coming to the realization that the line that players make plays is even more critical than ever before. You know, and your job is one that is much more, this is my personal philosophy, you know, one much more of preparation. You know, and you may make three calls, you know, during a season, or you may have a great timeout call, or you may see two or three adjustments or go into a zone then switch to a hybrid or whatever it is, you know, that make a difference in the game. But more often than not, you know, players got to make plays.
Yeah, sure. I mean, in the end, like Coach said, I mean, that's, I feel the same way. And I remember referees or other people talking to me on game day, and I'm like, you know, my job's done. I mean, I hate to say that, and I said it before in other years.
Right.
You know, I can sit back and be a fan. Obviously, I'm a much more vested fan because I have a lot more passion what's about to happen. But yeah, your hope is that you've gotten them to the position there, you know, that when that first whistle blows, that you don't need to coach. You hope that doesn't. I mean, you're obviously going to put some little tiny things here and there, but for the most part, yeah, that, you know, of that 60 minutes, probably 57 is stuff that you better hope they're ready for based on what you did Monday through Friday.
Well, like I said, you might make three or four adjustments, maybe even a half a dozen adjustments, you know, in game during a season that make a difference, you know. But if you're playing 16, 18 games or you get to the playoffs and it's an extended season, you know, at that point in time, it's up to the players, man. And that's why, you know, the culture is so important because, you know, the correlation between what they do in practice and what happens on the field is, especially as the speed of the game gets even faster and faster, you know, the fat guy is no longer the guy with the pole, you know.
Right,
Which was me, you know, I mean, I understand. But at the end of the day, let's transition into Georgia Tech. Hey, one of the things I don't know about you is, did you coach high school or anything before you took the reins at Georgia Tech almost 20 years ago?
Nope. Just helped some youth programs in Baltimore growing up, like we all did. We'd help our girlfriend's dad or something like that when we were in high school. But no, my first coaching is when I came down to Georgia Tech for grad school and walked out in the field with Sonny Pieper as the head coach and was assistant coach, and the rest is history.
Wow. So, Coach, let's talk about Georgia Tech, man. You've had a great legacy, and obviously the last handful of years, the team has been in the top five, Division I, MCLA, where most of those schools, you know, with a couple of exceptions, you know, maybe Virginia Tech or maybe Florida State back in the day or whatever it was, you know, are out west. How have you really changed or modified, or have you changed or modified the way you go about leading that program? Let's talk a little bit about your dedication to fall ball. Let's talk about, you know, your practice, your assistant coaches, and all that. Can you give me a 3 or 4 minute litany of how things have changed or maybe evolved is a better word?
It's a good question, and it's almost even hard to pinpoint it. I mean, it's, you know, really, yeah, the last 7 years, 8 years has been the real big change. You know, for the first 10, I think we just kind of put the key in the ignition, turned it on and ran, and what happened. You know, we didn't really have a direction of what we were trying to do. I mean, my first few years, I thought, I'm just here for grad school, I'm moving on, like, this isn't going to last, you know. I was not that much older than the players, so I didn't really know what our future had in store. So anyway, it was, you know, it really was the last 10 years where, you know, really we've had some huge alumni support. In fact, Bob Schack, who started the program, was integral with us early on and then took a break for some, for job issues in terms of he just couldn't be dedicated to us anymore in terms of off the field stuff. But the last, you know, as I said, 7, 8 years, he really got really back involved again and really has been the driving force behind the scenes in terms of helping us with recruiting, helping us come up with a plan of how we want to attack to get more recruits or how we want to build the program and, you know, asking for that little extra dedication in terms of trying to find recruited kids as opposed to just rolling out a ball, you know, rolling out a table at freshman orientation or trying to find kids that may have played. And so that was a real big push is when we said, yeah, we've got to change this. And so, you know, I said 7, 8 years ago, we'd get one or two recruits with, you know, 5 or 6, you know, sort of invited walk-ons, and then there'd be 2 or 3 walk-ons. And that would, you know, basically make our class each year. But then the more that Bob got active in terms of reaching out to coaches, and I think more that it didn't hurt that things like Georgia Tech basketball, and they went to the Final Four back in '04, and then there was still a reputation there. They needed the football team, and then even the fact that Tech is still a top 5 engineering school, more kids started looking outside of being, you know, what helped us recruiting wise is the kids started looking outside of being the 40th kid on a roster at Division I that had possibly good academics or good decent engineering program, and saying, hey, I could make an impact and maybe be a starter. Contributing player at a team that's a top 3 engineering school or top 5 engineering school, depending on what, you know, discipline they wanted to get into. And more kids started going, let's look at this. Let's look at this opportunity down in Atlanta. It's a great town. There's, you know, a lot of job opportunities. It's a vibrant city, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And that really started tipping the scales. And then really the recruiting at that point turned to our kids. Our kids became our best recruits, our recruiting devices. We'd bring kids down, we'd do senior days in the spring and fall, and they'd see that it wasn't just a nerd campus. They realized that there's life here in Atlanta, that there's, you know, tailgating, the SEC football's not that far away, you know, Florida's not that far away in terms of just getting away for fall breaks or whatever. We really just tried to show that there's more to more to life than just the academic side, that there is a social side, there is an athletic side in terms of what our program is. And with that, though, came me trying to find coaches that were dedicated. And we found, years for a long time, as you know, I had Rob Ling, who played at Harvard and was here getting his PhD after working for Kimberly-Clark. He was really the first dedicated coach I had, who was fantastic. He was a great friend, a great coach, still comes down and does camps and things like that with us. And then I got EJ Freeman, who played for me at a Vail, all-star team back in the day. I think one of the first travel teams out of Atlanta, actually, back in 2000. And then Matty Edmonds, who coached in the varsity world and had moved down to Columbus, Georgia, which is about an hour south of here, joined our staff. And that really locked me in because I was not a guy who wanted a rotating door. I had a lot of people over the years that wanted to, hey, I'll come help. Can I come help coach? You know, I'd love to help out. And they'd bring their bag. Like, they'd bring their bag wanting to suit up. I'm like, that's not how we do it here. That's not how we are. And so those guys were instrumental in terms of assisting me in terms of finding some more coaches that were dedicated, that this wasn't just going to – that they understand that the payment was going to be a huge amount of money, and by that I mean just apparel. that they could live with that and their spouses would accept it. And so that really – all this coming together 7-8 years ago is what is driven to where we are now. Bob off the field, you know, me playing between both on the field and off the field. You know, Matty, who can't be here all the time because the coaching has really worked more with Bob and the recruiting aspect. And then I've got EJ, and then I've had JJ the last few years as well, who's moved on to Auburn. And now I've got Kevin McHugh, who's a longtime Atlanta guy on our staff. So really all these pieces are coming together. We're getting talented kids. We're getting dedicated kids. And we don't need to worry about setting the table up at orientation. And really now our job is once the ball rolls out that we got to do our job coaching these fine young men. And it's worked out pretty well as we've seen the last few years. And we hope to only make it even better as we continue to go forward. Because it's not like we said, hey, at year 8, we're done. No, I mean, this only invigorates Bob even more to find more recruits, better players, you know, more financial opportunities for the program to fundraise, to raise the level for travel and things like that. So it's become a real competitive atmosphere for us off the field to try to maintain what we've built now the last, 7-8 years.
Well, and for somebody that's watched you coach and for somebody who's been on the sidelines coaching teams that were competing against Georgia Tech, at least me personally, I – always had the impression, and, obviously, scouted you up one side and down the other. There was almost a, and I thought it stemmed from you, and I'm anxious to get your comments. I always thought you were a defensive-minded coach. I always thought you had a very conservative game plan. I didn't think that Georgia Tech was a transition team or somebody that was risk-takers. They had incredibly strong defensemen, including the kid from Worthington, my high school alma mater recently. What was he, like 6'5 or 6'6 or something?
The
All-American.
Big kid.
Yeah, the All-American. But in the last couple years, I've seen, I think, a little bit more of an evolution, And before I let you go and expound on that, some of that, I think, you said something to me off the air that I've never heard you say before, just because we haven't talked about it. Now that we've had fall ball, we got to figure out what our offense is really going to look like because we have a different look on offense, And I'll never forget Danny Sheehan one time from Lemoyne telling me on a podcast, we were talking about somehow the issue came up about recruiting into your offense. And, you would think a storied program with the legacy of Lemoyne, he said, we really don't have that luxury of recruiting into our style of play. Syracuse does, but we don't. And so we never really know what our offense is going to look like until we see what we have in the fall. And the culmination of all these comments is last 2 or 3 years, I think I've seen a little bit more aggressive style of play from you offensively. So my question is all that fair? And what kind of things are you doing in practice to – reinforce what you think the offense would have the best chance to be successful in looking like once you get an idea of what you have?
Yeah, I mean, it's
Now, that was a hell of a question. You got to admit, man, that was a damn good question. Demonstrated research, empathy, observation.
I think, very well done, because I think that a lot of people are starting to, because, yeah, you're right, Mike. There's still, I still even had someone say to me last year, oh, you got to be ready. Or I was listening to the broadcast, the national tournament.
Exactly. I was too.
Tech tries to slow it down. They try to attack when they're lulling you to sleep. Like, that's not where we used to do that.
that's my point.
So that was our strategy. I mean, we'd sit around as coaches going, you know, our best chance is not to try to play run and gun because we don't think we have the offense to play a run and gun just because of our skill set. And we don't want to put our defense at jeopardy. We took real pride in always making sure that defensively we were going to be, you know, lock, stock, and barrel ready to go. I mean, we wanted to know that we were going to be a good defensive team. And we took a lot of pride even a number of years ago trying to have a streak there going of not giving up double-digit goals. The problem was we were only scoring seven goals at the time.
Yeah.
So, and we're still the same way defensively. But, yeah, what's changed in offense now, especially, again, with how recruiting has changed, is that, you know, EJ's really had to change his strategy. I mean, we look each fall trying to figure out, you know, what's best for us. You know, and that doesn't mean just we're going to push it. Hell yeah, we want to push it. I mean, don't get me wrong. I've always wanted to be an aggressive offensive coach because I still think if you can, the best way to put pressure on a defense is to not let them dictate to you what you're going to do. And if you play a slow down style of offense, in my opinion, that plays in the defensive hands. And so we didn't want to do that, but now that we have the horses that we can get out and we feel like we can run and gun at people, we want to play that way. I mean, we're averaging, you know, 13, 14 goals a game the last, you know, 4 years, I think now. And maybe part of that is because of our defense and the fact that we get more possessions. But when we get those possessions, we're not trying to sit on the ball. I mean, we want to get to the cage, especially on the initial clearing transition. You know, one thing we really noticed, especially in NCAA, and you see in the NCAA world, is that, you know, that transition of players, you know, often on the field. And really you see it a lot in the NCAA, in my opinion, with the vast majority of our opponents, is that when that ball's turned over, guys head to the box. And so our mindset is, let's not let their defense get in and settle up. We want to attack them as soon as we possibly can. And we go for that. We go for that jugular so that we're not having to play 6-on-6 lacrosse on the offensive end. So we really try to – that's what we work on. That's what we teach. And we work on it a bunch because we want to be successful at it. And if you look at the last number of years of some big games, I mean, that transition part of our game has been something that can get us, you know, hopefully 6 to 7 goals a game that we normally wouldn't have had. And so you compound that with your transitional goals, you compound that with maybe man up, then your settled goals, and that you're going to be at that 12, 13 goal number. I mean, we have a set offensive number we'd like to reach. But again, the point of what you asked, I mean, you are dead on. I mean, we are with the players we have coming in, we are trying to be more aggressive offensively, trying to find a lot more hybrid kids. We don't want true attackmen. We don't want true middies. We want kids who can play both ends of the field so that we don't have to use that box. I mean, I don't, you know, if I could go a whole game without using the box, you know, except in certain situations, I'd rather use the midline because the midline means at least I've got the ball where I want it to be and I can use that. But if I can transition and just use my box for after goals are scored, then I'm a happy guy. You know, I want my guys to be well-rounded that way. But, you know, that's what EJ does now in the fall, especially this nice freshman class we've had come in with some offensive talent, is trying to figure out what's going to be best for us, who fits right in what position, what sets might be best for us. You know, is the 1-4 better? Is the 2-2-2 better? Is the 2-3-1? I mean, it just depends, you know, again, where our skill set is and where we want to break guys down, you know, defensively so that we can be successful offensively. So, yeah, we've got a lot to figure out because this fall has really excited us because, you know, we had some very good offensive guys the last few years, but I think there's still a basis of them probably being just really good athletes like Holland Frost of the world, the Ben Mertz of the world from a couple years ago, and guys like that who, you know, are very good lacrosse players. But I wouldn't say their lacrosse IQ was through the roof. They were just amazing athletes that could get to the cage. And so, you know, having this group of guys now is really, really pretty exciting. And like I told you off the air, I mean, not one of them is a senior. I only have 2 seniors on the team, and they're both defensive players. So knowing that this offense will be around together for the next couple of years is really exciting for us and for hopefully the future of what we're going to be able to do on one side of the ball.
So, Coach, how is that progressing?
Defensively,
Oh, I was going to say, how has that progression manifested itself in practice? Are you running more transition drills in practice than maybe you did 6 or 7 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, but different styles. We don't run your traditional, like, we're not running fast breaks. Yeah, we do those, but that's not the gear. Like, what we really focus on, like I told you, is when that ball is being cleared, it's brought up field, that's not necessarily a fast break. We call it the slow break, phase one or phase two in terms of, let's attack the cage. It's probably 3-on-3 lacrosse, is probably what you're looking at, maybe 4-on-4 lacrosse as guys are running off the field, and my first guy's pushing it up. And so we want to attack the transition that way. And so by virtue of the definition, yeah, it's transition because we're not settled, but it's not an odd man situation. So we've
We talk about it on our site all the time. I mean, you know, with the advent of the extension of the box, I think, you know, true fast breaks, you might see one a game, you know, I mean. They still need to be practiced, and the progression with trailers, I think, and the add ones are all great ideas that I implement. But so, give me an idea what Georgia Tech practice looks like in the spring, Coach. In terms of the plan of the practice, have you modified the practice schedule? I mean, in terms of, you know, on our site we talk a lot about historically it was. You know, an hour of skill work, whatever that is, you know, spoke work, stick skills, shooting skills, redirects, station work, everything that goes into that definition in a macro sense. You know, and then maybe a little bit of transition, some 6v6 and 10v10. You know, now we're seeing guys open practice with transition drills trying to set the tone of the practice. And then you have guys like Danowski that have almost gone back to like a standing wall ball, a 10 or 15 minute two-man passing, you know, actually a human wall ball exercise, you know, to begin practice. So when those guys come out on the field, I assume we stretch, and then where do we go from there typically, Coach?
It depends. I mean, really, you know, I know a year or two ago everyone was about, you know, I don't want to say high reps, but high intensity and keeping it up to make sure it's sort of game-like. And we tried it. You know, the problem was, I'd say a few years ago, we had, and the weird part for our transition of our program is, if you look back at our roster even 3 years ago, we were down at like 28 guys, 30 guys. Like, we just had a lot of focused guys, and it was a small roster. Now we're at 44, 45 guys. That's a big change we've had to deal with in the last, you know, 2 years as coaches, because we came in with a mentality of, oh, this our old style will still work. Well, it doesn't always work, especially when you have more players. And so we've gone back and forth a little bit. This year, this fall especially, has been very individual-based. We want touches. We want to work on the little stuff. We realized a year ago when we had our big influx of a recruiting class, that we thought we needed to worry a bit more about theory and how we were going to play in terms of, this is the kind of offense we're going to run, this kind of defense, this is what we're going to do. And I think it showed as our season wore on, as we played tougher competition towards the end of our, you know, we played a tough schedule last year to begin with. But then towards the end, especially in the national tournament, there was this thing that we realized, even though 7 months later, you realize, boy, we just didn't approach that the way we probably should have. And so we really are taking this fall to work on, it's a lot of like what you mentioned, a lot more stick work, a lot more shooting, a lot of more individual based stuff, foot drills for defensive stuff, you know, sticks, a lot of passing, a lot more ladder passing, things like that. So, yeah, there's a lot more focus of us this year saying, let's tighten that up now this fall, make sure it's something these guys understand we expect of them. And so we'll start working on our spring stuff probably here in the next week or so once we wrap up fall. Because my plan from last year probably isn't going to work. We need a different look this year, especially with such a huge freshman class of 19 kids. You know, I've got, you know, just a couple seniors. They already know what to expect of us. They already know what the gauntlet's like to play in terms of once you're actually in season. So, you know, yes, but the start practice though, it's funny. Yeah, we do a lot of finishing drills early on. And it may be 3v3, 4v4, maybe some small side 3v2s. And the reason we focus on that is not just for, it's not for intensity. I think some coach said to me one time, because he came to watch, I said, it's not about that. For us, it's we want to make sure from the start of practice, these guys understand when there's an opportunity to finish, you had better finish. In fact, we have a penalty corner We stole that from our wonderful new basketball coach here, Josh Faster here at Tech. He's been kind enough to share some stuff with us. We've attended a number of practices. And when guys, they're big penalty corners if they miss layups. If they miss a layup, they have to go to the strength and conditioning guy. And for 1 minute, the guy puts them through torture for a minute. Whether it's, you know, up downs, whether it's sprints, whatever it may be, he comes up with something.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, we've incorporated that. So to us, layups are one-on-ones with a goalie, dunks. You know, we call them the same thing. We call them layups. And so if the kids don't finish it, they go to our penalty corner. In each practice, we have a different penalty corner, you know, penalty, I couldn't think of the word to use there, but it may be, you know, it may be bear crawls, it may be up downs, it may be star jumps, whatever it may be. But, you know, to me, on the defensive end, there's one thing. Keep up high side, go to the penalty corner. On the offensive side, it's layups. You know, we don't want to have a list of 20 things. We want to make sure there's two things these guys have to understand on each end of the field. And on the offensive end, it's layups. And so we start with that. So at the beginning of practice, the kids understand how important it is, because you're going to work really hard to get lacrosse goals. I mean, it's not easy work. And like you said, there's only maybe two, maybe three, if you're lucky, true fast breaks nowadays. You know, but when you have a one-on-one, that is so, I mean, it took work to get there by somebody or by a group. And so when you get there, you better finish, because you're just not going to have that opportunity as much as you think you are. So we really try to harp on that. So that's why practice starts that way. And then we pull back and start going to, you know, how do we develop or how do we get to the point where our program or our team can be having layups? And that's when you start putting in the work with other drills to start working on the fact of how we're going to get to the front side of that cage. And then you end the practice with, you know, something very similar so that we're, again, at the start and the end, and in the middle, working towards understanding how we're going to dunk the ball. And that's what we work on.
Interesting.
So, but the penalty corner has been kind of fun. We started that last year. And, I mean, you can see it at the basketball practice how much they hate when they realize they missed the layup. And our guys, they know it. I mean, they immediately, in some of these drills, I mean, they, you can see their head, darn it, now I got to get run to the corner. Because, I mean, that's less reps they're getting right now. We hate to do it, but we want to make sure they understand the importance of why we do that, and that is that, you know, in a critical moment, in a critical game, doesn't matter when you're up by 15, you miss a couple, guys kind of laugh about it, oh, you got stuff. What I care about is, no, you need to be performing that same level when you're up by 10 or 12 goals as you are when it's a tie game. I mean, it's so important.
It's funny, man. I can remember, I haven't thought about this in a long time. It's like 7 years ago or 8 years ago, back when Serino, before he was the AD, when he was still coaching at Limestone, Ken. When they would play 6-on-6 or even 4v4, and the offense, any guy would throw it away. The other offense had to run to the other half field and do 17 or 18-second sideline to sidelines. And as soon as they had done like a minute or 30 seconds, I don't recall exactly what it was, but it was something like that. They would come back in and immediately be the offensive unit on the 4v4, the 6v6. You know?
Oh, yeah.
So they were actually more tired, but it was a very similar philosophy in terms of emphasizing, you know, in this case it was turnovers. In your case, it's finishing or giving up the high side. Hey, Coach, what's a drill you're running in practice that the kids love that maybe you didn't run 7 or 8 years ago?
Well, what they love and what I love are two different things. But they, you know, they do like the – we do a split side 3v2. That's really one of our backbones to start, or a short side 3v2. So they love that because it's a lot of quick, rapid touches. It again, forces them to move to different spots, have to squeeze passes in, you know, again, finishing on top of the crease. We do a dome drill, which a lot of guys do. It's just a typical 4v3 box thing. They like that just because it's an offensive-minded drill. Trust me, my defense absolutely hates any drill that gives the offense an advantage. I mean, they have a passion. Your boy Will from Worthington, who graduated last year. I mean, when we blew the whistle to run that drill, he would just drop his head like, gosh darn it, I hate this, you know, because it puts the defense at a disadvantage. And I kept trying to remind him for 4 years, you're never at a disadvantage. Never as a defense. When you're down one guy, you're never, because you still have a goalie. So it's 3v2. I still got three defensive guys. I got a goalie and two defensive guys. 4v3, I got three defensive guys and a goalie. So if I'm doing my job defensively to try to force a bad shot, my fourth guy's there to make that save. And so I try to drill in their head when there's a transition opportunity. It's not a negative. It's actually a positive. If you've got the same number of guys they do, we're just going to put one guy in the cage. And so let's make sure that guy in the cage can be successful. Let's make sure that shot comes from a spot where a shooter's uncomfortable. And so if we can do that, and we can work on that and realize it's not just an offensive drill by visual because there's an extra man. No, to me, that's more of a challenge defensively, that you got to learn to step up because not, you know, this when guys slide or maybe a two slides missed, you're now playing man down. You're now playing a disadvantage. And so you had better be ready defensively, not just to go, oh, darn it, Timmy missed his slide. It should be, uh-oh, how are we gonna change this to make sure we can get it back into our favor again? That means getting a lower quality shot, maybe getting a stick in the passing lane, getting a stick on the hands, whatever it may be. To me, those drills are just as important for defense as it is for offense. So to me, that's a drill. I like seeing those sort of odd man drills, people call them, because I still think there's a great teaching opportunity defensively there.
Well, you know me, man. 70% of my practices are transition. You know, oh, gosh, I wish I had – somebody just sent me. They were playing the instead of like a short field, on my site, Ken, I don't know what to call it, so I refer to them as crunch drills. You know, anything that is, you know, put the cones out 15 yards or whatever. And he, I'll write an article and I'll give the guy credit. The D2 program. Oh my gosh, I can't remember. Anyway, the guy was looking at my site and they were playing, 3v2 in the girls arc. Or excuse me, 3v2 in the short girls arc. And then immediately it would be add one. They would go 4v3 in the bigger arc. You know, so each group would get like two reps in there. I thought that was pretty cute. I can't wait to try that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Coach, what's the dome drill?
Yeah, those are all, those are good ones.
Ken, tell me about the dome drill.
The dome is just your typical, we just call it a dome, but it's just, you know, four guys on the outside, three defensemen, you know, there's three lines up top, two are offense, one's defense, down below is two lines on each side of the cage, one offense, one defense. Coach throws the ball to one of the corners. Either one will play it as a ground ball to push it into a 4v3, or we just throw it in the air and they have to cut. They have to cut to open. They have to cut for the ball, receive it, and then basically run a 4v3. But the kids just love to yell dome. I don't know what it is about it, but we yell it. I mean, the whole place erupts. They just loud dome. They just, it's their, one of their favorite things to do is the dome drill.
Well, you're miles ahead of most coaches, man, because after doing this for 9 years, I've come to realize that coaches are really terrible at naming drills.
Oh, and I'll be honest with you, I don't even know where that name came out of. I'm sure. I'm not the smartest guy in the world by any means. I coached at Georgia Tech, but I got a PE as a major in college. You know, I'm not more than happy. I've gone to enough clinics and you know, black cons, whatever you want to call it, and watch stuff online. I mean, I don't sit back in my notebook that's 100 years old with the same drill. I mean, I'm always looking for something new and fun and different that maybe there's something I'm looking for. And again, when we realized we were not scoring as many one-on-ones, we started looking for drills that would create odd man situations, hopefully for our offense, to have more inside looks. And so I'm sure there's some coach that named this thing the dome. And so that's where our guys took off from it. But it is sort of our end of practice and near our end of practice. Common, maybe once or twice a week, maybe once a week, just depends on the week. But again,
right,
it's a drill that we like to run because again, it locks in what we talked about at the beginning of practice. And that is, you gotta finish, you know, and it also goes along with what I just talked about defensively, that defensively, you gotta understand situations and what can you do besides just throwing your hands up saying, oh, they got more guys than us. No, how can you play this situation that, you know, you can actually benefit from it or maximize your defensive effort from it.
Coach, what percentage of your drills are half field versus three quarter field versus full field?
Good question. That may change this year. And this is no knock. And we've had a very successful team the last couple of years. But I think the back end of our team the last year, and those guys are hard workers. Trust me, I love them. But, you know, we weren't deep defensively. I mean, I'm sorry, offensively. And so it was really tough for us to do a lot of drills splitting up because a lot
right.
of times
just
my defense is just so deep and strong. I mean, as you know, our defense has never been a problem for us. We always get defensive kids attacked. I mean,
you had a kid that was an All-American goalie for like 18 years there, Sommerfeld. I mean, I don't even know how he was in college for 27 years, man. I mean...
Listeners, they get
4 years eligibility. He had 4 years eligibility. I'm not suggesting any impropriety. I'm just saying I coached against that kid in high school. I coached against him in college. He was just great, you know.
Yeah. I mean,
and huge.
He's a a player, and him having was huge. But he'd be the first to tell you that, you know, Siren, Will Byers, you know, the guys that played in front of him were phenomenal defensively, and made his job. I mean, he made some amazing saves, but, you know, defensively, you know, those guys were making his job pretty easy 80% of the time. And so when it's time for him to shine, he shone, which is great. So, yeah, but even our third string defense, a lot of times, especially this year, I mean, I still think I'm 8 or 9 deep at pole this year. My third string D will beat up, I mean, destroy my third sort of run O. And so if we try to split, right, what we learned a couple years ago, it was tough for us. We weren't having much success offensively. It was just more frustrating. So we, you know, our goal this year is to do more full field stuff because we know we have the horses now, we can run. But we felt like it was more probably beneficial for us to be doing more half field stuff where we could keep more eyes on guys on both sides. You know, so our goal already, just talking just sort of, you know, casually between EJ and I, as we're the ones that set everything practice wise, that we are afforded, because we've already done a little bit this fall where I've taken half the team, you know, I've taken one end, he's taken the other end, and then we swap just so we can see what we want to see. But we have enough horses now, we can do both ends, which again, will change our spring practice, which is exciting for us.
Yeah, I think I got that from Pressler, man. I started to run a lot of the stuff I ran half field beginning at three quarter field, you know. But again, you know, you can't do it. Like if you're a high school coach, you got a 28-man roster, you know, after three reps, their tongues are hanging, man. You know, and it's not a matter of conditioning or heart or attitude or anything else, you know. You got to structure the way you practice. We've had a couple of coaches on, Ken, that go a half field, a full field, a half field, a full field, a three-quarter field, a half field, you know, mix it up that way. I've never really experimented with that before.
Yeah, I would say we're probably more that style, and it's not that we're trying to be creative. It's just manpower and coaching power. What can we handle today? You know, if I had JJ, Matt, EJ, and I, because I mean that's part of what we talk about as coaches. I mean, this is different in MCLA than varsity, obviously. Where in our world, I have to send a note like who's going to be here, like going into a week, like who's around this week. So that I can plan, all right, well, we'd love to do this, but boy, if I only have, say, EJ and I, it's a little different practice than when I can say, okay, I've got Kevin, Matt, if I've got all four of us, we'll run a different practice than if we just have the three of us or two of us. And so that will determine a lot what we're going to do that week or what we're going to do that day or whatever it happens to be.
Well, and I think that's kind of the evolution of coaching, too. You know, I think when you and I were playing, the coach probably didn't have a practice plan on paper, but he had something in his head. And, you know, you were just going to do it come hell or high water. You know, I mean, we're going to run 6v6 for 20 minutes, you know, and two of your starting attackmen are out. And the drill is worthless, you know. It's really not accomplishing anything for anybody, you know.
Yeah, I have no idea how you did it. I mean, I think you were pretty much by yourself a lot of times. And, you know, and there's even times when if it's maybe I'm running late or EJ, if it's just one of them. I mean, I've had to run a practice in the last couple years by myself, and I know EJ has too, and it's tough. I mean, it's tough to try to move all those pieces around. So there's granted, having mature young men like we do at Tech that I'm lucky, very smart kids, I can turn to an upper class if I need to and say, hey, let's run, why don't you run this with these guys? I got to take care of the defense down here for a little bit. And so that helps a lot as well. But, you know, yeah, it's a tough battle just trying to massage the whole thing together.
Well, I know it was an adjustment for me going to a 45-man roster. But once I made the adjustment, I thought it opened up a whole world of different drills, you know. I could run, you know, three-quarter add, you know, or, you know, emulate a guy getting beat backside, you know, out of a 4v3 starting my dome drill, not at the, or for lack of a better description, I love the name, I run that dome drill in pregame a lot. Just because depending on where you roll the ball, you know, it's a different look every time, you know.
Sure.
And I can focus on the D middies in that top position a lot of times, you know, with the LSMs and actually have them cheat. Like, you know, let's say we were going to play Georgia Tech and they got a guy named Frost that's all world. You know, we're going to cheat towards Frost, you know, and make somebody else beat it.
Sure.
Hypothetically. Yeah, I think you'll get a kick out of the bigger roster and what it opens up once you make the adjustment. You know, it's an adjustment for everybody. But then I kind of had a hard time going back, you know, to the high school level and practicing with the smaller rosters because by that point, 30% of my drill book was unusable, you know?
Oh, sure. Yep.
So what's your favorite drill, Coach? And we'll wrap it up.
Mine, again, I've taken it from somebody recently, but it's just a defensive slide drill. You know, we call it hub. I think that's where the guy, the coach that I took it from. But essentially, it's running 5v5 lacrosse. And, you know, the offense starts in either a 2-1-2 or a 1-4-1. And we're attacking from the different points, whether it's top, side, back, wherever. And all it is just a communication and slide drill. Now, it's a good offensive drill as well. I mean, it's about dodging and reading and all that stuff. But, you know, the real mind stake in there is to try to make sure we've got 3 to 4 guys understanding slides at the same time and communicating through all of it. I mean, that's one thing I think we've been very, very good at and continue to want to get better at is our general slide package in terms of just how our defense reacts. And so having a drill.
So, Coach, in that drill, are you jumping the first slide to make it a sliding drill?
Nope. Nope, we want them to have to react. Right? I never want to run a forced sliding drill, only because I don't want them to become robotic. I want them to have to learn to read and evaluate the game. Because again, we want them to have to learn to read when we switch slides in the middle of a dodge. You know, we go from our numbers package to our delta package. You know, if a guy falls too far below or rolls back, whatever it happens to be. I mean, you know, and trust me, it's a good question because I mean, our offensive guys when they're trying to rotate through. You know, when a guy starts dodging, they immediately just go. They just immediately slide, and that drives me bonkers. You know, I don't want to put my defense on their heels if they don't have to be. What I want you to do is learn to read and evaluate the situation to figure out what's the best for us defensively at that moment. You know, and that's what we try to really drill. And again, we do this drill. The guys will tell you, I don't think I've missed a practice without doing it. I mean, I always do this drill because to me it's so crucial to the understanding of communication, the understanding where you're supposed to be, what responsibilities you have. And EJ does a really nice job of making sure that it's not a stagnant offense, that it's not just, okay, this guy dodged, this guy, you know, it helps.
So the guy that gets the ball, he's got to go to the cage? Is that how you initiate?
No. Well, we bang it around. We want it to be realistic.
Right, okay.
The ball bangs around, and they've got an option. They know. I mean, we tell them if it's in a, you know, 2-1-2, then, you know, we're dodging, we're filling the top side. Crease releases, you know, offensively, or you're looking through to bang it through, you know, to X, whatever it happens to be. The offense knows what to do, but yeah, we know. I hate the blow whistle and start dodging thing because that never happens in lacrosse. And so we want them to bang the ball, so our defense has to learn to move, start communicating. Because every time the ball moves, there's a different slide, pretty much, or different communication. So we want to make sure they're getting the habit of that, and then they go. And then once that happens, we've got balls around the outside. You pick up a ball, they go again. We ideally like to get a top wing and X dodge on each set. And then we rotate. The next group goes. And then we just keep rotating. It goes pretty quick. And again, the whole idea is just defensively to understand your responsibilities and with the key thing being communication, positioning, you know, footwork. I mean, that's how I love the drill. And again, but EJ's done a nice job with his offense. And again, same way, them understanding this isn't just a defensive drill. You know, we try to make sure every drill we do is not just one-sided. You got to understand there's a component to both sides of the ball whenever we run a drill. And you know, this isn't rocket science by any means. But when I introduce it, it's introduced as a defensive drill. But EJ does a really nice job of counterbalancing that. Same thing when he puts in an offensive drill. I'm counterbalancing it saying, don't look at this as an offensive drill. That's how it's introduced to you guys. But here's the opportunity for you on the other side of the ball.
Yeah, good stuff. Hey, man, it's already an hour. Goes fast. The Georgia Tech lacrosse camps have just been a, you know, cornerstone for, I think, especially youth lacrosse here in Atlanta, Georgia. Can you tell us where we go to get information on that? And if you're a coach listening to this and you've got kids or now that you can't coach your high school varsity team, you're working with the middle schoolers or the there's so much more U9 and U13 lacrosse in Atlanta than there ever was before. Can you tell us where we go for information on the Georgia Tech lacrosse camps and approximately when the dates are? Is it June?
Yeah, actually, it's end of May, last week of May.
So, end of May, okay. I knew it was early in the summer, yeah.
Yeah, we try to get ahead of all the travel stuff, even though it's impossible to avoid all that stuff anymore nowadays. And, you know, we still love having the opportunity to work with kids in Georgia. We do a lot more clinics nowadays and go out to the programs and do it. But our camp has still been around for, you know, over 15 years, and we love doing it. We know there's a lot more competition in Atlanta, a lot more kids playing, but, you know, we're still trugging right along and having fun with it. But it's just at gtlaxcamp.com. We have our 7-on-7 tournament coming up here in about a month, which is, again, was sort of something we started, I guess, 13 years ago now.
It's a really popular event. Really popular event.
Yep, we have a good time with it, and hopefully we'll continue to flourish. But, you know, we love being involved with the community and doing whatever we can. I mean, we are the biggest lacrosse program anywhere around Atlanta. I mean, you got Macon. You know, you got Mercer down in Macon. That's over an hour away, and they're obviously, you know, Coach Tyle's done a nice job down there. But, you know, we feel like we'd like to be involved as much as we can, you know, without taking away from these kids' academics. I mean, we are an academic-first school, and we respect that and honor that, but we still like to make sure our kids, because we have kids that, I mean, our roster is littered with states. I mean, we're probably one of the most diverse rosters
in
the NCAA,
no
I
would doubt.
Like to say. And we want our kids to, and the kids come from good areas. I mean, New York, Baltimore, Maryland, you know, Pennsylvania, Jersey. And these kids grew up with these kind of things and admiring their college team. So it's a pretty easy sell for us to tell our kids that we're going to do this or do that. And they sort of jump right on board because they knew it's what was done for them when they were kids.
Well, man, I know that you and I have had some competitive moments, but I also want you to know, as I've told you many times, you know, how much I respect the footprint that you've left personally on lacrosse in Georgia. And, you know, you've done an amazing job. It's just great to tune in when you guys are playing in the playoffs in California. And, you know, I just, you know, hook up my Apple and stream it off my phone on the screen. And Alice watches with me. And, you know, I'm very fortunate to know probably five or six of your players anyway, personally, or I've coached them in the past. And watch what you guys have done. And like I said, to, you know, the best compliment I can give you is, that I've watched, you know, the program, evolve consistent with the type of players that you've had. And those players aren't coming to you by accident. You know, your recruiting efforts and I know when I was coaching Copperheads, we would be like wherever, you know, whatever state we were in. And, you know, Maddie was there and, you know, I would welcome the opportunity and did every time to allow him to talk to the team. You know, he was doing that with a lot of teams, you know, at those tournaments. There's not too many MCLA programs that have a guy that played, pro indoor lacrosse and knows lacrosse and has the personality, and the charisma that he has, you know, to address those teams, and your whole staff is just great assets. But, Coach, I can't thank you enough for coming on. I'm sorry I ran over all the time. It's just kind of the way it goes sometimes. Hey, thank you so, so much. Stay on with me here for just a second, and we will wrap this up. Lax Coach Mike, back to the radio voice, Ken. Lax Coach Mike, LaxCoachMike.com. Man, you guys got an incredible responsibility. Influence in the lives of these young people. Take it serious every single day. Until next time, God bless everybody.